Well, welcome everybody. Bit of housekeeping to begin with. I'm going to hand around this sheet and you will put your Christian name very clearly on here. And if there is an empty seat next to you, you'll leave a blank on these lines, just in case somebody comes in late. This is my way of knowing who you are, because I can't read your name things from here. Some of you I just about can. I can see Ambrose's if I squint. But that's because I saw it before. I'm cheating there. So, put your name on there. Thank you. Thanks. Good.
Just hello, thank you.
Please, good.
Welcome back, Michael. It's just wonderful to have him again. He's been to New York giving courses in American literature.
Not in American. Yeah, American literature, drama, and poetry. Yeah.
And also today is the great Michael's 50th anniversary of his...
Not me, that Michael.
This Michael. 50th anniversary of his profession. So he's getting old and long in the tooth. Like me. So it's great to have you, Michael, back. It's really...
Thank you, Mary.
We consider ourselves privileged, and as you know, as a former flyer, Michael received the award for outstanding teacher at ACU. Was it beyond ACU as well?
No, it was just ACU.
It's wonderful anyway. We know it's the truth.
Good. Okay. Thank you, Mari. Well, it's a privilege for me to be here too, I can say that. So it works two ways. Yeah. As the names list is going around, just a few other housekeeping things. You have a wallet in front of you. You have in there, you have the poems that we'll be looking at, plus plenty of space around the poems to make notes if you wish. You also have a little booklet inside there in case you want to expand your thoughts, develop your thoughts. This seminar is not intensive. It's really, hopefully, an opportunity for you to relax with the creative word, to experience the creative word, to collaboratively share what the creative word contains, and maybe to find a way of expressing your own creativity through that, either whether it's in a critical format, like, you know, writing comments on the poetry, or some of you quite often in past courses of here have actually been inspired to write some poetry, and that's come through and people have wanted to share that. So in later seminars we will make space, if it's needed, for people to write their prose or poetic responses to what we've been covering in the course here. So let's just begin by a little introduction. People might like to say briefly who they are and, you know, why you're interested in Francis Webb. No more than two sentences per person. So please, David. Oh, you passed the microphone around. Thank you. Oh, yeah, one other...
Oh, this one, right. Okay. Is here, right?
One other housekeeping thing. Sorry to interrupt the flow, but if you need writing instruments, there they are. Together with a pencil sharpener. So, as you can see, I'm a school teacher. Go, David.
My name is David Hurley, and I didn't know what to expect, so I'm glad I'm here. I've been listening to the songs or the poetry of Leonard Cohen recently, so it got me going to come along.
Good, fantastic. Yeah, lovely. You know, Leonard Cohen's very much in the air at the moment. In fact, I bought a copy of his poems and prose on a sidewalk bookstore outside Central Park 3 days ago.
My name is Stan Cowper. I have no background in poetry at all. I went to a technical high school and then to a technical university. And I'm trying to fill up a gap in my life.
My name is Colin Keating. I've known Francis Webb of him since 1966. I worked out when I met her sister Pauline, a good Sam sister, who he came up to her convent in Pennant Hills, and she told me about him. and I was speaking with her one day, and I've always been fascinated with her ever since.
And you work in the Chatswood Library, do you?
No, I met you in the Chatswood. Okay. I went to two of your Francis Webb days. Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, yeah. So I've always, I find it very hard to read and understand, but I'm always fascinated with it.
Yep.
I'm Mari Biddulph, and likewise I knew Pauline, and so I appreciated him through her initially.
Yeah, great.
My name is Jared Shanley, and I like reading poetry, so that's why I'm reading.
Lovely, Jared. Thank you. Yep.
Okay, Kevin Burgess. I hadn't done any analysis of poetry since 1946, until I came to your session last year on Michael's recommendation, and I enjoyed it very much.
Great.
So I'm back.
Welcome back, Kevin.
Michael Whelan, and I'm seeking solace in the poetry of Francis Webb today after a fairly heavy day yesterday. Thank you.
Ambrose Riche. I'm an artist, a visual artist, but before I became a visual artist, I was very, very interested in literature and poetry, and in a way, I'm sort of returning back to that to find some kind of connection between visual arts and basically the written word, I suppose.
Yeah. Yeah.
Artists like Apollinaire are favourites of mine, and somehow Francis Webb really somehow ticks the boxes on all kinds of levels.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't understand him fully, but I absolutely, he's got my attention, absolutely. Yeah. So thank you.
Wonderful, thank you.
I'm Margaret Lee. I've been interested in Francis Webb for a long time. I have your book, Godsville, and I have the collected poems edited by Toby Davidson.
Yep, yep. Beautiful, thank you.
Anne Redmond, and I've been to some of Michael's courses before, and he introduced me to Francis Webb, so I'm here for some more. Thank you.
Great, good.
I'm Cecily Gordry. I've been interested in Francis Webb since my teenage years. Not that I understand it, but I have studied and dipped into it.
Yeah, good.
I'm Rose Griffith. I met Mike in 76 when he was writing his thesis on Francis Webb. And we did some research in England when Francis Webb moved there for a while. And it's some of his poetry is beautiful and some is very clouded for me.
My name is Gavin Schultz. I've always liked poetry very much. I don't know anything about Australian poetry, so I thought I'd start with you.
Great. Lovely, Kevin.
Hi, I'm Peter Shelway. I did the painting up the back, so to a scene. Painting that was based on one of Webb's poems that Michael will do towards the end, sequence called Ward 2. Space 2, I did a stint of self-nursing, and I met Francis Webb when he was in Rhymney Hospital. So a lot of the references are to that time.
Hi, I'm Cheryl, Peter's partner, and I know Francis Webb through the eyes and ears of Peter.
Thank you. Yes, we can you hear me well enough? Okay. Turn it off, yes please. Thank you all. I'm very grateful that Peter is here today. It was only yesterday, in fact, that I remembered that I should have contacted him, that I was going to show his painting during this session. And so I'm really amazed that he was able to get up and come to the seminar today, which is really good. I've known Peter for quite a long while. We introduced Peter at some of our early Francis Webb seminars back in the 90s. And people were very interested to hear Peter's story about his connection with Frank Webb in the hospitals. And when we heard about this painting here, we actually bought this painting for ACU, and it's in our possession. And we'll be referring to that painting in the last seminar. That's where we're moving to. It's called Ward 2. So you've all mentioned your connection with Francis Webb. I'm going to talk about my connection with Francis Webb too for a little while. But just to tell you the structure of this handout here and how I hope to move through it over the next 4 weeks, I've actually arranged it chronologically. Francis Webb was born in 1925, but he actually started writing poems in about 1940 when he was 15 years old in Chatswood, past the 10th Chatswood. And so there are quite a few early poems here. And then he produced his first major collection of poems, A Drum for Ben Boyd, on page 5, produced in 1948. And this poem was really celebrated by the press as a remarkable poem for a, you know, 22-year-old. And he was lionized as, you know, a major new talent in Australian poetry. So much so that Norman Lindsay, who was then in his heyday illustrating works for poets and writers, offered to illustrate Frank Webb's book, A Drum for Ben Boyd, and then Ludwig Leichhardt, his third book. The relationship between Frank Webb and Norman Lindsay was very interesting, because on the one hand, Norman Lindsay gave great clout to Frank Webb's publications, a young poet, not known by anybody, and now illustrated by Norman Lindsay. But Norman Lindsay, up there in his eyrie in the Blue Mountains with his naked women and his hostility to religion and especially his hostility to modernism, was like a bitter drink to Frank Webb. And so there was a great deal of tension between them. And the quotation at the bottom of this slide here comes out of a letter that Frank Webb wrote to Norman Lindsay. Norman Lindsay was telling Frank Webb, you've got to write your poetry so people can understand it. You've got to simplify your poetry. None of this modernism, none of this obscurity. And Frank Webb responded, 1948, age 23, I have been doing my uttermost to be truthful and to get my alternatives and contradictions down to the last bedrock. Now, that sentence resonated with me hugely. It was as if, you know, here was a poet who was, you know, not concerned simply for kind of outward simplicity or communicability. The poetry was, for him, was the stuff of his inner life. It was his means of trying to get down to the core of his being. It goes without saying that Frank Webb at this time and throughout his life was deeply religious. He was a Catholic. He was brought up a Catholic. He was a Catholic of a pretty hot persuasion, I might say. He was, you know, he certainly wasn't a conservative Catholic. He broke many, many rules, as we will see. There's Judith Wright's comment about him. He's done so much suffering for me, and I've read him so much, and I think that's what poetry is for. So, A Drum for Ben Boyd, and then we move through to one of the poems in A Drum. The next poem, page 6, is from Leichhardt in Theatre. That was his next publication. Can say a little bit about A Drum for Ben Boyd and Leichhardt in Theatre in terms of their subject matter. They're interesting. Frank Webb was very drawn to the heroes of Australian history as part of his wish to put himself on the map as an artist and as a poet. What was it that he found compelling about Ludwig Leichhardt, Ben Boyd, and later Edward John Eyre? Leichhardt and Edward John Eyre were both explorers, and they had, you know, horrendously difficult explorations across the Australian landscape. And Frank Webb, with one part of him, saw that his effort in life was to kind of try and break through this huge, impossible weight of material. He needed to find a way through that. That leads me on to talk very briefly about Frank Webb's life. Frank Webb had a hugely difficult life. And in a way, I suppose that's what drew me to him. I felt this spirit wrestling with the materials that we all wrestle with, but in him it was tenfold. He had two sisters. I knew both his sisters. He had three sisters. I knew two of his sisters. I never actually met Frank Webb himself. I first made contact with his poetry in 1973, which was actually the year he died. Just to come back to his life, his mother died when he was 3 years old. He came from a fairly wealthy family. His parents were... His father was a musician in North Sydney. They moved to Adelaide. His mother caught a serious cold and died of pneumonia at the age of three. And there were four children in the family. And his father couldn't cope with the four children in Adelaide. And his father, in fact, had a nervous breakdown. And his father ended up in Callan Park Hospital. And Frank Webb hardly ever saw his father after that. It's not even known whether he saw his father once. So he was really orphaned at the age of three with his three sisters. And he was brought up by his grandparents in North Sydney. And they eventually moved to Chatswood. So Frank Webb had this huge hole in his life. And his poetry really reflects this. He's seeking for some point of inner stability. And he has his deep faith from his grandparents. But there's the kind of matrix out of which his poetry comes. Now, added to that, after the huge success of Ben Boyd, he was drafted into the Air Force just towards the end of World War II. He didn't see action, but he was sent to Canada to train as a tail gunner in Lancaster bombers. When he finished that training, the war had finished, and he wanted to come back to Australia via England because he had forebears in England. He wanted to find something out about the land where his forebears had come from. He got to England, and he had a serious nervous breakdown. And his sister Leonie went there and rescued him. He wrote a couple of poems while he was over there. One of them we're going to look at shortly, on first hearing a cuckoo. When he came back to Australia, he was diagnosed as having chronic paranoid schizophrenia. Sorry for that. Turn you right off. And he virtually spent the rest of his adult life in and out of mental hospital. It was an accident of fate that I happened to be, before I went to university, a male psychiatric nurse in Parramatta Psychiatric Hospital, where he had been a patient about 5 years before I got there. I only found that out later. I started university, Sydney University, studying Australian literature, and our then professor Leonie Kramer introduced us to a whole variety of Australian poets. One of them she put in front of us was Frank Webb, and I was very interested in this poetry. One poem in particular grabbed my attention. That's the one we're going to look at first, on first hearing a cuckoo. And I made some comment about, I remember making some comment about Frank Webb and how much I liked him. And I remember Leonie Kramer saying quite distinctly, "Don't spend too much time on him, he's mad." Well, that got my gall. I went across to the library and I found this book, Francis Webb Collected Poems, the original one that came out in 1979. And I read in the introduction that quote that's on the screen there by Herbert Read, eminent British art and literature critic, that Frank Webb was the most unjustly neglected poet of this century. I couldn't quite square that with what Leonie Cranmer had said in the class. There's something that kind of burnt in my soul there. So a few years later, when I'd finished my main degree and was then going on and really wanted to study poetry intensively, I wanted to do Francis Webb. Leonie Cranmer wouldn't let me. She would not let me. I had to fight tooth and nail. Eventually, after about 12 months haranguing with her, she said, "Oh, all right, you can do it, but only as Frank Webb in the context of the poetry of his time." So you can imagine the title of my thesis: Frank Webb in the context of mid-20th century poets. That's how it turned out. I didn't spend too much time on the other poets. I think by the time I'd finished, she'd gone. So that's a little bit of background to my own connection with Frank Webb. I'm digressing. So in this booklet here, we then move on to his next book on page 8, called Birthday, which contains his wonderful sequence on St. Francis of Assisi. It's on page 8. And it contains particularly his poem, A Leper, based very much on St. Francis of Assisi's own experience of the lepers, and how the lepers were for St. Francis the way of breaking through his own egotism to some truer connection with reality. Frank Webb certainly kind of dramatizes his own experience through the leper. And on page 12, the last item in this volume, Birthday, was actually a play called Birthday. And it was a verse play which was produced by the BBC in 1955. But the ABC in Sydney refused to perform it because it ended with the line, or not ended, but near the end of the line on page 13, Frank Webb dared to say, "All I am going to say, Hitler was a human being." That alienated the ABC so much, they could not deal with that. The play was never published. But it's very interesting to ask how it's possible that Frank Webb had St. Francis of Assisi and Hitler together in the one volume. It was his great work of 1953. Yeah. And then on page 14, we move to his next book in 1961, his more mature book, Socrates. Titled Socrates, it has a title poem in it called Socrates, but it contains some of his most well-known poems. It contains 5 Days Old, Hospital Night. It contains his sequence on page 16. There's part of it from Air All Alone. And just to come back a little bit about the explorers, Air All Alone and Ludwig Leichhardt. You know, Frank Webb, he was, in one way, he identified with the heroic struggle to kind of break down internal, external opposition. He talked about, on page 17 there, you can see underneath that image of the Banksia, Frank Webb said, "Edward John Eyre's journey around the Great Australian Bight comes from seeing such a journey of discovery as suggestive of another which is common to us all." So when you read Frank Webb's poems of exploration, which are actually very similar to Patrick White's novel Voss, written at the same time, incidentally, you can see the creative artist using a heroic figure, you know, as a metaphor for the spiritual search, for breaking down layers of the ego. And both Ludwig Leichhardt and Edward John Eyre, as they confront the desert, that is their kind of main source of opposition and of transformation. It's the way in which they come to a connection with their own inner reality. And the poem that I've chosen there, Banksia, is just an amazing, amazing celebration of an epiphany as Edward John Eyre, rounding the desert around the Great Australian Bight, sees suddenly the bright red Banksia cochineal, the brilliant red Banksia, which we don't get in New South Wales. And it's like a beacon of awakening for him, it was. Then we come to the book he wrote in 1964, The Ghost of the Cock, which is actually also a play. The title of the book is titled, the title comes from the play within the book. But within this book, you have the wonderful poems that he wrote when he was hospitalised in Norfolk. And as Rose mentioned, just after I finished my PhD, I got a grant from the Literature Board to go to Norfolk and explore the landscape there and the hospitals where he'd stayed. Just amazing how, despite the incredible difficulty of his life, and there are descriptions of him walking around hospital grounds with plastic bags containing his books, and his books, incidentally, the books that he had in his kind of portable library are all housed in the Chatswood Library now. There is a, because Chatswood is the place where he went to school, where his grandparents moved, there is a Francis Webb reference library within the Willoughby Library, and there are all the books that he used through his life, his very heavily annotated Gerard Manley Hopkins and many other poets. And there are also some of the paintings that he bought when he was in England. He got a Literature Board grant when he was over there. What did he do with it? He went out to the antique shops and bought paintings by some of the Norfolk School artists. And just picking up on Ambrose's earlier comment and your interest in the connection between poetry and art, one of the things that attracted me so much about Frank Webb was this amazing interconnection between poetry, the visual arts, and music. Throughout his work, he's passionate about music. He's passionate about the visual arts. He often talks about poetry through metaphors drawn from the visual arts and from music, all intertwined. In one way, he's often jealous of the musician and the artist who seems to have a more direct way to heaven than the person who has to struggle with the metaphors. Look on page 18, he says here, talking about the work of Anthony Sands, the artist that he loved, "Birdsong is your reverberating touch." That's one of my favourite lines from Frank Webb, incidentally. That line, taken out of context, speaks volumes to me. "Birdsong is your reverberating touch." Now, he's talking about Anthony Sands, the artist, but is he talking about something greater than the artist? And is the birdsong a mediator of that reverberation? And the poem ends with, his second line goes, "But metaphor is the enormous second frozen." And the last line is, "Cannot sustain that feather gentle word lies gaping on the stockpile or the floor." So Frank Webb has this deep-seated sense of the difficulty and the complexity of words and language, which he had to wrestle with in his life. And the work of the artist and the musician kind of takes him beyond that. So it's a really interesting poet to consider from the whole question of human creativity and the capacity of the creative word to connect to our own deepest self and to the divine. And then within this volume, on page 21, we have perhaps his most celebrated sequence, Ward 2, which Peter Solway has illustrated on this painting behind me. When Frank Webb was in Ward 2 in Parramatta Hospital, and I was in Ward 2, and it was a medieval nightmare. You would not believe the stone walls, the sense of total exclusion, the sense of being with just insanity. Within that world, Frank Webb wrote a sequence of poems about the inmates there. And each one is filled with a sense of the glory and the humanity of these individuals that are within there. Quite remarkable. So I've just got two of those poems here. We've got A Man and Wild Honey, which we hope we'll get to that in the last seminar. And in the very last poem I've got here is Nessun Dorma, which Frank Webb was, you know, very deeply attuned to Jussi Björling. And Nessun Dorma, of course, in its title, None Shall Sleep. Well, there's, you know, we could spend hours on that poem and how that poem, in a way, encapsulates so much of Frank Webb's own quest for meaning in his life. At the end of this little anthology, there's appendices. The first appendices is the introduction to the collected poems by Herbert Read, which you've got that one quote from there. I'd just like to read to you the last paragraph, which is on page 27 in the handout, Roman numerals 8 and 9. From the beginning, Francis Webb has sought that so tender voyaging line of truth. Now that's a quote from one of his poems. That so tender voyaging line of truth. Single-mindedly and with a somewhat disconcerting unawareness of the fashionable poetry of his time. His early work shows the distinct influence of Kenneth Slezer, a remarkable Australian poet whose Five Visions of Captain Cook and a sequence of 12 poems called Music might have inspired Webb's earlier verse. Browning and Hopkins are perhaps obvious influences. But we need not seek further for the sources of his prosody, which is not modern except in its psychological and metaphysical intensity. From the beginning, Webb has been concerned with the same tragic problems as Rilke, Eliot, Pasternak, and to mention a contemporary who presents a close parallel, Robert Lowell. I cannot, after long meditation on his verse, place his achievement on a level lower than that suggested by these names. Unknown Australian poet. So, you know, that was pretty remarkable. The other things that you've got in the appendices, you've got the introduction to my own book, God's Fool, which, if you're interested, incidentally, there are no more copies left. This is the only copy I have left. And you can buy it on Amazon.com for about $130. But you can buy the digitized version for, I think it's about $11 on Kindle, if you're interested. And then last but not least, a wonderful article here, which I actually included the last time I ran this course also, by Judith Beveridge, Making Space for the Inner Life. Judith Beveridge is one of our, you know, most accomplished Sydney poets living nowadays, and a deeply spiritual writer who really understands something about the way words in poetry can evoke some connection with spirituality. So I will come back and make reference to that, but that's the booklet here. And I created this booklet last week, and when I sat down on Friday, whenever it was, I thought, my God, how are we going to get through all this? So, you know, don't expect that we're going to get through all this. This, in a sense, is your... What word can I use? It is your compendium, your resource. And read widely in it. And, you know, maybe you can lead our discussion at some point. You know, if there's something really jumps out at you and we haven't covered it, could be, please go and look at whatever. And we will do that. So, without any further ado, I would like to go and have a look at this poem here. On First Hearing a Cuckoo, which actually comes from not his early poems, but it is from Leichhardt in Theatre. And with Toby Davidson. It was mentioned earlier by Margaret. Toby Davidson recently, last year or the year before, did this fantastic job of bringing together all of Frank Webb's poetry. 2011. And he's added significant annotations to it. I'll just read you something here. During 1949, Frank decided to return to Australia from Canada. And since he was already halfway around the world, he determined to do so via England. In England, Frank suffered a breakdown, was hospitalized. It would appear that Frank wrote at least two poems during this, his first trip to England, on first hearing a cuckoo and Morgan's Country. Frank arrived back on Australian soil on May the 20th, 1950, having made a brief stopover in Rome to complete the 1950 Holy Year pilgrimage and praying in four patriarchal basilicas. Now, the title of this poem is a reference to a tone poem by the English composer Frederick Delius, on hearing the first cuckoo in spring, which was actually based on a Norwegian folk song brought to Delius's attention by Percy Grainger, none other. When I first read this poem, I was truly mystified, and I think it was the mystification that drew me to it. There was a sense of something incomprehensible, ineffable about this. Knowing something about when it was written, about the fact that Webb had suffered a breakdown, was in hospital at the time, certainly adds something. Webb was about 24 or 25 years old when he wrote this poem. And it helps to hear the Delius. And we will play the Delius in a moment. I want to read the poem through first, and I want to engage you with questions and first impressions that you might have. And then when we've had those first impressions, we'll listen to the Delius and see what it adds. The Delius composition is very much about English spring and a sense of reawakening life and greenness in particular. Francis Webb was writing this poem at a time when Dylan Thomas was popular, when modernism was, you know, very much in the air in the arts, surrealism, and you could see why Norman Lindsay, who, you know, was very much a kind of a Banjo Paterson man when it came to appreciating poetry, would have found a lot of this language oppositional, incomprehensible. So let me read the poem, and let's have a preliminary discussion about it, then listen to the Delius, and then come back to the poem. On first hearing a cuckoo. It was never more than the two unchanging words heard first in the coming green of daybreak, the sleepier green than sleep, with a sheer white between this yawning advancing green and the colour of all lights out. Not consciousness, the awakening early green, for that was the steep curtain, immediate structure of pain and learning, familiar rattlings. With this taut white wariness, two words involved themselves, form and changeless, cool and haunting. Because they were of distance, I had tended to link them with the young, tremulous, begging green now scrambling in a tree, moon-eyed at the window, wanting to be let in. Yes, now the breeze of green rejected distance, pulled cleverly at the curtain, exposed a laundry mark, disordering the image while reaching not the self's hand-scoring rigs. But they were quite apart, so freely entering, so at home, not softening, not disturbing, but making distant. Old story, devious green, all shapes and sizes of illusion, turned right out of doors. Two words, always the same words, freely entering. Heard next while playing cricket at 11 in the robust green, long strider and talker of vital distances, while the downs, the chalk hills around southern England, while the downs kept on and on, voyaging green, and chafed the skyline's thin stalkage of personal mood along their sides. Trees bulged, battening on a sleek green's passionate act and story, plump with spring. And here, among the withstood gross distances, green loggerheads, two level and small words, never at odds with self, never with green. And last, at dinner, when the dissolute green summoned to bedside each image, unelectric against lights out, gay sufferer with the syrinx. Syrinx is a singing bird's larynx. Also, it's a shepherd's panpipe. Gay sufferer with the syrinx become this tree, enigmatic as a covered statue. Green shoulders of the downs converge to the humble, drooping lekythos. That's a lekythos on the bottom right of the screen. An oil flask, a Greek oil flask. So the humble, drooping lekythos, the dead souls unstirring at the folded forelock. Shadows freeze. Sad, elongated faces, fine hands extended downward, pouring the winds, shivering in the queasy grey trickle of nightfall and mixing airs, dissolving distances. Then the changeless words, unelectric among the going green and the advancing colours of lights out and the nagging strands of an anger, and cool before the cavernous green of sleep which alone could lose them. What in themselves? These two words. 12 hours shaken away. Not the abandoned green remained, not self, not spring, not Surrey, no, nor merely a dead word-haunted man. Two words remained, the language foreign, childish perhaps, or pitiable, heedless of enmity, again and again coming to a taut candor, to a loose, warbling green. When you hear the Delius, you will hear the two words in the first part of the composition as an oboe and a violin. And at the end of the composition, you will hear the clarinet, very much like a loose, warbling green. But before we go there and listen to Delius, let's have some observations and comments. And please, I'm quite welcoming observations that say, this is totally incomprehensible, I want my money back.
I want my green back.
You want your green back?
Just a minute, use the mic.
There's such an empty...
It's not on yet.
There's such an empty...
Not on yet. Not on.
Oh. Oh.
That's it. Sorry, just before we go, where is... Here it is, the names list, I've got it. Thank you. Yep. Stanley. Not unfortunately.
The title, I have trouble with the title.
Yep.
Vigard basically spent his life in the desert.
Oh, hang on a second. The title is the title of the book in which this poem occurred. Oh. So the book title has nothing to do with this particular poem.
Thank
you. All right, good. Any other comments, observations, or questions? Mari.
My first automatic reaction is to the...
It's okay, but a bit louder.
Okay, I think you might have to turn that over. I couldn't help but think of a Ravinia in that first little section.
A what, sorry?
A Ravinia. You know that the free read of the Ravinia, it's just so free. And I got distracted with that completely, and the rest of it is... dull,
the rest
me,
is
but
silent.
It was so alive for me, that experience of the Ravinia at Colo, actually, just outside.
What can you describe the Ravinia for others? What is exactly the Ravinia?
It's a tree, and it's very, it's a lime green tree, very bright. And it just dances like a little... ballerina,
yep.
So freely, and it just speaks of early morning to me and
right.
Aliveness.
Right.
But I just got so caught up that I got distracted with the rest.
Okay. Well, that's a really useful comment because, you know, one of the things that this poem seems to move between, it is that light, freeing sense of green and awakening and his attempt to capture something of that evanescent quality, and yet there is so much darkness and convolutedness as well that, you know, is expressed beautifully in his phrase, a word-haunted man. And there's that kind of tension. So, thank you. Anybody else have a comment? Any other comments? Please feel free to speak. Ambrose, yep. Bit louder, Ambrose, please.
Analysing the poem,
yep.
The impression, because I hadn't read this poem, but the impression was, as you say, there was a sort of a dark foreboding about it. And I think, I'd like to think of him not as much a poet as a thinking man.
Yep.
In other words, he's responding and he's dealing with the, if you think of the generalised idea about what language is.
Yep.
Language describes the world to us. We create it. The poet uses it in certain ways. Painters use it in other ways. And musicians, etc. But basically, it's the language by which we inform the world and give value to it. And I think this is the struggle he's playing around with, which I find obviously very interesting.
Yeah.
Very interesting. So he's holding back from being celebrating, but rather wanting to, you know, talk about what's those sounds that he hears from the birds.
The two unchanging words.
Yeah. It's inconsistent with the language in which he moves, and we all move as a society. And I think this is quite good because there is something harrowing about it. That's what I'm thinking of.
So that's really interesting, and you raise this fascinating question about the language of thought and the language of poetry, because the two are quite distinct. You know, T.S. Eliot spoke about poetry as language reaching into the silence, and thought, of course, ties you down to attempts to explain, etc. Yeah, I resonate with what you say, but I feel that this poem has got both elements in it. There's this musician reaching out to the sounds and the colours and the textures, and the visual artist reaching out to these textures, but there's also this kind of struggle with his own sense of here and now-ness. You know, for instance, in the first stanza, he says, when he's describing green, not consciousness, the awakening early green, Consciousness for him is something quite different. Consciousness, for that was the steep curtain, immediate structure of pain and learning. Like, you know, I can relate to that experience. You know, when you wake up in the morning, sometimes you have a kind of a clean slate, and there's this incredible sense of freshness and immediacy. And then the old thoughts start coming in, all the complexities and the rigors and the confusions, the familiar rattlings. And, you know, he uses the word rattlings in other poems, often alluding to rodents, to like rats in the brain.
I agree with you, Michael. And as a painter, I would say that one of the legacies of the 20th century was that not only did we create an image, but we had to create within that, when people experienced it, was the process had to be visible.
Yes.
So it's that process of doubt,
yes,
and indecision that gave the image and the,
yeah,
the actual work that extra quality. Yeah.
That's really interesting too, because, you know, in a sense, the lines I've just read there, they are in a sense kind of taking us into the process of the poem itself, aren't they? They're like within the process of mentation, the struggle with how is he going to relate to this experience? Does he want to kind of enter full consciousness, or does he want the experience to kind of shape him and enter his being?
Yeah, that's fantastic. And this is also, I suppose, is a bit of a segue to his interest in St. Francis, I think.
Very much so, absolutely. Yes.
Not Hitler, but St. Francis.
St. Francis, yeah, yeah, beautiful. Now, somebody else had a hand up around here. Peter, did you want to add something? Grab the mic in front of you.
Just a short program.
Bit louder, Peter, into the mic.
Program, nature program, yeah, just out of breath. But it was about a lot of cuckoo birds.
Yep.
And they're pretty ruthless with their nesting, don't they?
Yeah, they are.
They kick a baby out, put,
yep,
their own egg in,
yep,
and then their baby grows up and kicks the other. Very ruthless birds. And I'm sure there's an element that Webb would have been aware of the life of cuckoos,
yeah,
beyond the beautiful song. So back to that ambiguity with, yeah, a rather darker sense of conflict.
Okay. Yeah, interesting. There's certainly a dark conflict in there. Yeah. Did you want to add something, Cheryl? No? Okay. Michael, did you want to add something? Yep. And this will be the last comment before I turn on the Delius, and then after the Delius, we'll have a cuppa. Michael.
That's almost a throwaway line, the first one.
Which one?
The first line, the first stanza.
Oh, yeah.
It was never more than two unchanging words, is it? But that's triggered something.
That's right.
The way he goes.
Yeah.
And it's almost, in spirituality, we talk about the apophatic way and the cataphatic way. Dennis Turner, Anglican theologian, says, you've got to talk until you get to the silence where words fall over in the apophatic. And in that last stanza, watching themselves, 12 hours shaken away, not the abandoned, and listen to the number of times said, not, and no,
yeah, yeah,
not the abandoned green remain, not self, not spring, not Surrey, no, nor merely a dead word or the man. Two words remain.
Yeah, right.
It takes you beautifully through, I think, a very fundamental journey that,
yep,
spirituality recognises.
Yeah, yeah.
Your imagination is captured, the door is opened into a, yep, deeper spiritual world. You become alive with words, you talk about it, you probably chatter too much.
Yes, yes.
Until you get to the silence, no, not this, not that. Just the two words.
And building on what you've said, look at the last three lines. The language, foreign, childish perhaps, or pitiable, heedless of enmity, doesn't matter. Again, and you know, the last line and a half, the music, the poetry of the way in which those last two lines really kind of engage with the moment of the experience, again and again coming to a taut candor, to a loose, warbling green. Okay, let me go here. Let me see if this works. go harder. Yeah, that's it. So, come back to the present moment. It's time for a tea break now. And then we come back and we decide whether we want to spend a little more time on this or whether we want to go on to another part. So please.
I was just going to say, you know, the